This episode of Forensic Forecast is brought to you by Digital Forensics Magazine at www.digitalforensicsmagazine.com and by contributions by our listeners. Thank you all very much. All right, welcome to Forensic Forecast. As always, I'm your host, Lee Whitfield, and joining me this week, Eric from New Jersey. And, well, hello, Eric, first of all.
Hello, thanks for having me on again.
No problem. You're welcome back. And as that's not obvious enough, you're on every single episode.
So yeah, obviously, you can't get rid of me.
And we'd also like to welcome Ron, who's first time on the podcast. And Ron, I can't remember where you're from exactly. Where are you from?
Oh, I'm from California in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay. Oh, very nice. Lovely weather that so, over that way.
Lovely weather. I'm about a mile from the bar where they found the new iPhone.
You didn't have anything to do with that, did you?
No.
You didn't get $4,000 off Engadget or anything like, not Engadget, Gizmodo.
Gizmodo, I wish. No.
Cool stuff. All right, well, we've got a few bits and pieces to talk about today. But first of all, Eric brought something to my attention a little bit earlier on today. And I'm going to read this cause verbatim, okay? One of the things we can just discuss is how both the US soccer team was robbed in the World Cup against Slovenia and how A Fistful of Dongles was robbed in the Forensic Forecast Award nomination process.
But I'm not bitter or anything.
No. Then you go on to say, I blame Lee for both, of course, which actually seems to be the trend these days.
Well, yeah, it was the theme.
It's all my fault. Which, you know, that goal should not have been disallowed. That referee apparently is being sent home from the World Cup because of that decision. Won't be refereeing any more games. However, that's too late for the US because the 3 points would have been invaluable.
Yeah, now we have to beat Algeria.
Yeah, well, you could probably do that. We couldn't. We really sucked, but oh well. We'll expect to see all the England players home in a week or so. But as for the Forensic Forecast Awards, yeah, I think that's worth talking about just for a few minutes. We did the nomination, started the nominations at the end of May, ran them for a couple of weeks, and unfortunately, Eric, although he got quite close with A Fistful of Dongles, he was beaten out by some quite stiff competition there with the Sans Forensic blog, Harlan Carvey's Windows Incident Response blog, and the Happy as a Monkey blog. And they were the three finalists in that category. So, you know, while, it's, you know, you can feel quite upset that you didn't make it, Eric, I think that...
Yeah, getting beaten by Harlan and Sans and Happy as a Monkey is that's fine with me. I can understand. I don't even remember how I voted, but I bet I even didn't vote for myself. I bet I voted for Harlan. Which, it's my fault. It was probably my one vote. I missed it too. Voted for Harlan.
But about the Forensic Forecast Awards, I mean, for those of you who saw last year's coverage of that, it was a bit, well. Yeah, there's no word for it. It wasn't fantastic, and it wasn't like really, really well organised. This year, however, it's going to be done at the Sans Forensic Summit in Washington DC on July 8th. And it's going to start at 7:30 local time, and found out this week that. Not only Ascend's going to do a simulcast of the event so everyone can watch it online, but if anybody happens to be in the Washington, D.C. area and there won't be around or available or they haven't registered for the Ascend's summit itself, you can still gain access to the Forensic Forecast Awards without any registration whatsoever. So it's open to all. Anybody can attend. All you've got to do is show up. So, as a side note, voting is open until At the moment, it's July 6th. I might extend that so people can vote at the summit as well.
Oh, wow.
But we'll see about that, because that potentially is a logistical nightmare. So, but yeah, please go to the Forensic Forecast website and place your votes there. But
and get your, I think it's going to be a packed crowd at the summit. So if you're on the fence, you might want to get your registration in, because I know that they limit it to a smaller number of people, because that's they want a smaller, a little more intimate event rather than some of the larger conferences. So it's going to be an excellent event, because not only do you get to see all these great super gurus who come up and do their presentations, but because it's such a small event, you can actually talk to them and interact with them. So it's a really unique experience Rob is putting together.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, getting to talk to people like Rob Lee and Harlan Carvey, and, you know, the extensive list of other people that are going to be there, is a real, real privilege. And like you said, there's all the forensic gurus are going to be there giving the presentations, and me. So
I'm sorry. If you get invited, I know you're very humble, and that's great, but if you get invited by Rob Lee to present your material at the Forensic Summit, you've entered guru status. I don't care if it's kicking and screaming, but you're there.
Yeah, I think I'm too young in the field for that, but
Well, I always wonder, are there more than maybe 8 identifiable people in the forensics world? Because there's Rob Lee, there's you and Harlan, and not that many others, are there?
It depends on how long you've been in the community and how many people you know. I mean, if you look at, for example, some of the folks who were nominated for the Forensic Forecast Awards, some of the people actually have been asking, Lee, I've seen some, I don't know if it was a tweet or something, I think somebody was sent to me asking, hey, can you guys explain, you know, some of who these people are, so that, you know, we don't have to Google it. It's like, well, all right, Google it. But, you know, Nick Furno, you know, I know who he is. I know Lee knows who he is, but I think some other folks don't. And like Jimmy Wegg, I certainly know who he is. He's a law enforcement officer in charge of the Montana Division of Criminal Investigations computer forensics function. And he does a lot of work in the law enforcement world, and he's very well known for his knowledge of, you know, browser artifacts and peer-to-peer clients, and he does a lot of education stuff just informally. So the longer you're in it, and the more time you spend like on the listservs and going to conferences, you start meeting all these really amazing people. But yeah, as far as the A-list of people that everybody knows, you know, these are the people like Rob Lee and Harlan, because, you know, Rob is very well known because of his association with the SANS Institute. I mean, he's the driving force behind their forensics function. And, you know, Harlan's a good example because he's very present on a lot of the email lists, and, you know, he's written books, I mean, great books. So, right. You know, the best way to get known in the forensic world is write a fantastic book. You know, everybody knows who Harlan is because he writes great books. You know, everybody knows who Brian Carrier is because, you know, he literally wrote the book on file system forensics.
Yeah, I'm sure there's like there is a small group of like the forensic celebrity status type people, I think.
There we go.
You know, the forensic celebrities, and there is a small very niche group, but I think that, yeah, when you look at like at LinkedIn and Twitter and the forums like Forensic Focus and Digital Detective and all that, people do interact quite a lot with each other, and so people get to know each other quite quickly, I think. So
I've heard you called the Amy Winehouse of forensics, but I don't know why.
Come on.
Oh, man.
I've already had a hard week. Come on. Dear, I'll take that. It's without the drug and alcohol abuse, but maybe the same attitude.
Maybe.
And certainly, I'm a much better singer than she is any day. But
there we go.
Dear, oh dear. Oh, right.
Say router for me. I love it when you say router and not router.
Router.
There we go. Okay.
So, yep, go vote for Forensic Forecast Awards. Don't vote for Forensic Forecast. Don't feel any pressure. Don't vote for me. Don't feel any pressure there. Vote for whoever you feel is right. I've just got to say one more thing about the awards before we move on. The actual awards themselves this year are going to be absolutely fantastic. Last year, we just didn't give anything out because, like I said, we had like no budget or anything. But this year, my employer, Disc Labs, have kindly offered to furnish the awards. And they are brilliant. They're going to be like the proper geek chic thing to have. Once you see one, you will want to win one next year. Trust me.
Oh, awesome.
Just, great. It is going to be fun. All right. So moving on to some real news now. this week, Access Data and CT Summation announced that they were merging. And Eric, you know probably a bit more than most on this, having spoken to the people at Access Data a little bit. What can you tell us about it?
Not much. You know, you and I had a conversation via email with somebody I want to identify, because I'm not sure he wants to be publicly identified, but he's knowledgeable enough where it's a merger. It sounds like, you know, the controlling, you know, Access Data is still going to, you know, it sounds like they're still going to be the driving force behind it. But the interesting thing about this is a very big move for Access Data, because this signals that they are very serious about competing in the e-discovery space. And if you, Owen Casey has a really good book, he just came out, his Handbook of Digital Investigations. And one of the things that he describes really well in it is the kind of three different subfields that are in digital forensics. One is e-discovery. The second is, you know, a lot of what we talk about here on the podcast, which is, you know, the traditional law enforcement and intelligence type forensic stuff. And then there's the incident response forensics, which really bleeds over into the second one.
Yep.
But for a long time, one of the things I learned very early in my career is you cannot use digital forensic tools and processes to do e-discovery stuff, because digital forensic tools are designed to look in the shadows, and they're very detail-oriented and they're very precision-oriented, yep. Where e-discovery is more of a blunt object type situation. It's a lot of data mining. You have to take a lot of large data, turn it into a lot of small data, and then you have to put it in a format that can be reviewed almost always by attorneys. In doing something like that, you know, NCASE and FTK are just not designed to do that. But Guidance Software and Access Data are smart, and that they know that, you know, e-discovery is where you make a lot of money. So there's been a lot of research, a lot of development, a lot of effort put into e-discovery, not only by the traditional computer forensic vendors, but by a lot of vendors who just started up as e-discovery vendors. So if you want to make money, you have to play in this world. So what Guidance Software did is they viewed the e-discovery world from the prism of NCASE. So their NCASE, they have a very popular e-discovery product that they put on top of NCASE. And it seems to have done well from them, from the reviews. I haven't used it before, but, you know, if you read the reviews, it's pretty well reviewed, and they have a, you know, a bunch of different licensing options. And so Access Data, you know, as they've, you know, reconstituted themselves after getting the venture capital and some folks from Guidance going over there, they have really put an emphasis on the enterprise market. So they have, you know, an enterprise tool, they have an enterprise incident response tool, and they have been really pushing at doing the e-discovery tool. I didn't see this one coming, because, you know, Summation is one of those names, just like Concordance and some of the other tools out there, that are just, you know, something I've always, the names I've always heard when just talking to attorneys and e-discovery people. I've never heard Summation discussed by digital forensics people. So the fact that these two companies are merging is huge, because this means that Access Data not only is very serious about the e-discovery market, but it's also, you know, they just bought, you know, a lot of really good intellectual property are merged. I keep calling it a purchase, even though I know it's a merger. So it's interesting. You know, I was telling somebody the other day, it's like, you know, it's more than a shot across Guidance's bow. It's more like chain shot into their rigging, because this is them. this is Axis Data saying, we're here not only to compete with, you know, the traditional digital forensic vendors like Guidance Software and the other people, but this is an announcement that they're also going to start competing, you know, in this e-discovery space, you know, by buying a traditional e-discovery company. So the question is, well, how is this going to look? And I was at SansFire, it seems like a lifetime ago, because it's such an overwhelming experience, just a couple weeks ago, and some of the people I talked to there were concerned that, oh gosh, they're going to mix the tools, basically cross the streams, and, you know, I don't want chocolate in my peanut butter. You know, I don't want any discovery tool in my forensic tool. And I don't remember the email that we got from our source specifically, but it sounds like that's not going to happen. I think they understand that, you know, the digital forensics people want their digital forensic tools, but it sounds like there'll be some ability to have the two tools work with each other, so that, and it makes sense. Axis Data already has all the acquisition stuff. They've got that down, you know, FPK Imager, they've got their enterprise tool. So if they can use that technology to collect the data, and they've got, you know, the very good indexing engine, and then you take that data and let's say you export it out into a nice package and you put it into your cool e-discovery tool that you own and you charge your clients for. And now that tool is used for more of the legal side, where the attorneys are reviewing it, and they can, you know, produce out of that tool and all the traditional e-discovery stuff. You may have the merger of both, best of both worlds. So it's very exciting. We'll see what happens. And it just shows that, you know, the competition is good. That's one of my big things here. You know, I want Guidance Software and Axis Data to both win, even though I know, you know, they want one to lose. I like the fact that we have the competition, because we get this sort of information. And I think this will be good for digital forensics examiners too, because there's more of a convergence sometimes between digital forensics and e-discovery. So it will be interesting to see how this pans out.
Yeah, I mean, the press release which they sent out said Axis Data will be the majority investor of the combined entity called Axis Data Group, and will lead the day-to-day management of the new company. So it sounds, you know, they say merger, and like you say,
it feels like a purchase.
It sounds like it, yeah, exactly. But we've also been guaranteed, pretty much, through the people we've been talking to, that from a user's endpoint, so from a forensic investigator standpoint, you won't notice any difference if you're doing, like, the legal side of things. You won't notice that much of a difference. So if you're a forensic investigator, you will just keep using Axis Data the way you use it. But if the discovery need arises somewhere down the line, you can use that. I mean, personally, I hate e-discovery. I think it's boring. That's just me.
Well, it's data mining.
Yeah.
I don't mind it. I wouldn't mind managing an e-discovery function, but actually doing e-discovery, I'd rather pluck my eyeballs out. You know, I'd or staple bacon to my face and put my head in a piranha tank than do e-discovery work on a tactical level, because it's difficult. You have to hire very smart people with very specific skills that aren't necessarily the same skills that you would hire for a forensic examiner, because it's not the same tools. What I've noticed is what you really want to have are the people that have really good programming skills, really good developmental skills, because a lot of the tools, even the stuff that you buy off the shelf and get off the shrink wrap, you still need a good developer to tweak to your purposes. So it's a very different skill set, and it's just not – e-discovery isn't finding the bad guy. E-discovery is it's taking the data mining, and massaging the data, and getting it ready for the lawyers to basically go find the bad guy or do whatever. Yep. So that's why I like more of the incident response and the digital forensic stuff. To me, it's a little more intellectually interesting. But, you know, on a high level, to me, it's interesting, the processes and all that behind it. But actually, you know, if I have to do the day-to-day tactical work, I'd much rather spend my time inside of an image.
Yeah, I very much agree. But I think do you think there's going to be a lot of people out there who are a little bit worried about maybe things changing slightly with Axis Data's the tangent in which they're going here?
Well, it's a lot of change. I mean, it's a lot of change for Access Data. I mean, that's the biggest thing that they have to manage is, you know, they're kind of this tanned, rested and ready company now that they've got this venture capital and they've got all these new people running it. And now they've gone from, you know, they've done a lot of very innovative things. I mean, they had, you know, there was that FTK2 debacle. But now they have FTK3, which works, you know, as I call it, FTK3 ideology. And now they have, you know, now they're entering the e-discovery space. They're, you know, from the press releases and from my conversations with them, they're having very good success in the enterprise space. So, you know, it's a lot of change, and that affects their customers. And that's why I think it's very important for both Guidance Software and Access Data and any large, you know, discovery, or excuse me, a digital forensics provider to do communication properly with the community. And we're starting to see some noises from Guidance Software that they realize they haven't been doing things right and they want to make a change. And I think one of the things that Access Data has to learn or has to manage is they're not immune from that also. So they need to keep talking to the community. You know, what they used to do, like Guidance Software, their model, which worked great, was they used to have, I don't know if you ever had the pleasure of meeting him, Bill Siebert used to work for Guidance Software. His title was, I think it was Director of Customer Relations. He was basically the ombudsman, and this is back when, you know, Guidance Software was in the bad old days, and they really rubbed people the wrong way. But no matter how angry you got at Guidance Software, you really couldn't get angry at Bill, because Bill was an awesome guy. And his job was basically to interact with the community and interact with the customer. And if you had a problem with Guidance Software and you kept banging your head against the wall, you know, I always could go to Bill, and Bill would run around and kick butt and get things done. So the suggestion I've made, and I put it on my blog, was, you know, I think both these companies, if they have the money to, they should hire somebody whose job is, you know, primarily to interact and communicate with the community, because you have, you know, like I said, I've been in this almost 8 years now, and the change is just communications has been amazing. We have all this, you know, a lot of us are on Twitter. We have our blogs, we have our podcasts, we have all these email lists, we have all these conferences. So I think it makes sense to have somebody whose job is to kind of communicate and facilitate the communication between the community. So Guidance had it right once. So I'm wondering if anyone will ever do that again. You can never replace Bill Siebert, but that model was still a good model.
You know, one thing which I wonder about personally is that you see Guidance taking over Tableau, you see Access Data coming in and effectively taking over an e-discovery company, and we know what the history is with these two companies. We know that they have good products, but in some key areas they fall short from time to time. Now, what would worry me as a forensic investigator is, you know, is their attention going to be divided here, and is the product which, you know, is at the moment works all right going to well, for lack of a better word,
is it
going to
keep
worse?
Working? Yeah. Right. Quality control's always been their problem. You know, with both companies, Guidance Software, you know, if we had a Guidance Software major version release that ever went smooth, I mean, there's always some bird problem. You know, there's always some issue where we're like paid public beta testers. FTK, you know, FTK2 was, you know, I never got it to work properly. So the concern is, you know, hopefully they bought, you know, hopefully when Access Data bought the other company, they got a developmental staff, because when Guidance bought Tableau, they got the Tableau developmental staff and they got Rob Botchek. So they've got actually more tools to do what they want to do now. So hopefully Access Data isn't in the same situation where, you know, they're not splitting or dividing the attention of their development staff, because, you know, Access Data, you've got a good tool now. You've got FTK3, it works great. So, you know, yeah, just keep that up.
I think for Access Data, we don't know what their financial status is like, obviously, because they're not a publicly trading company. But for Guidance, I mean, we know that last year they had a shortfall of like $20 million, and right, they made a load of cuts and stuff like that. it just seems unusual in a time when there's a lot of financial turmoil that these companies are actually reinvesting money rather than closing ranks, so to speak. So,
well, that might actually be a good idea for them to diversify, because if you're Access Data, now you have more openings into the legal market. And if you're Summation, well, then you might have more opportunities to get in on the government side.
Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's an excellent point. Both companies need to sell their products to enterprise customers, you know, corporations, large law firms, government. So anything they can do to make inroads in there, that makes sense. It's a hard market to get into. I mean, it's hard to make money doing digital forensics just as digital forensics. I think you have to have a broader product line. I think that's what we're seeing both from Guidance and Access Data.
Because remember how close Access Data was to actually buying Guidance when they actually proposed that they were going to buy
them? I don't think that was a serious
offer. You think that wasn't serious?
No, I don't. And I love you guys, Access Data. You know I do. But I think that was a very sharp PR move. My spider senses went off on that. And the sources I've talked to have said that may not have been the most serious offer ever. Wonderful PR move, but I don't think that was ever going to happen.
I'm even more skeptical than that.
Well, it's not skeptical. That wasn't a serious offer. That was a brilliant move on the part of Access Data to get some buzz. But
oh, absolutely. But I mean, my really skeptical side, I see that, you know, there's people on the Access Data board who not long ago worked for Guidance. And I think there was certainly something a bit more personal.
Somebody was having a lot of fun with Guidance software. Yeah. And Guidance didn't respond to it very well. This is a good example. Access Data had a very good PR move where they made a move on Guidance and they had this buzz generated. And you got kind of a terse response from Guidance saying, no, you know, this is silly. We're not paying attention to this. But they should have come out and said, no, this is silly. This isn't a serious offer. And, you know, but they didn't. And maybe that's a bad idea. Look, I don't know corporate communications. So, you know, I'm a digital forensics guy. Yeah, I'm not a corporate communicator. So I don't know what I'm talking about. But to me, it would have seemed to be a good idea to say, this is silly, guys.
You got to think about Guidance's stock price as well, though, haven't you? As a public trading company, is it if somebody expresses an interest in purchasing your company, whether it's serious or not? All of a sudden, your share price bumps.
I think their share were around $3, and now they're up to almost $6, or about $5.75.
Yeah.
Well, and that was a time when the market was really bad too, so everyone was down. So Guidance's stock price was down. You know, the market was terrible. I mean, everyone's price was down.
Yep. All right.
What do you think if say Google, back before they had all these privacy issues, had bought Guidance?
Cool.
You know, there's always been the speculation that, you know, Guidance or Access Data will get purchased by like a Symantec or a McAfee or something like that. So I would not be completely surprised if we woke up Sunday and saw that announcement for either of the companies. I have no indication, no idea at all that would happen. But I've always wondered about that. And when I talk to other digital forensic examiners, everyone else seems to have the same idea, which is, what happens if a bigger security company decides to buy one of these companies to, you know, expand the product line? And it's probably going to be a matter of can Access Data and Guidance Software show that this is a profitable thing that they're doing, you know, trying to do the e-discovery and enterprise stuff. And if it is, then, you know, maybe you'll see a buyout someday. If there's a reason to buy them, maybe somebody will try and buy one of them.
Well, I'd be interested in hearing your ideas about forensics as a service, where, you know, some company with a zillion servers like Google or Amazon or something comes in and says, hey, you know, instead of taking days to analyze your data, we have a server farm you can rent from us for a day.
Yeah, the processing power, like using the cloud to do the processing power, you know, and I think we just did our buzzword bingo because we actually went our show now where we mentioned the cloud. So this is the portion of the show where I'll do my Luby reference and we'll also wonder what Mark McKinnon thinks about PI licensing. And now we've got all the check marks marked. yes, you know, that's interesting because you have, you know, you got this model now that you can harness all the CPU power to do certain things. Although the interesting thing, a lot of stuff, some of it's like processing is CPU intensive, some of it's IO intensive. So it wouldn't surprise me. Well, I think about password cracking. Can you imagine? It's like, hey, I got a password I need to crack. Oh, you know, and I got these servers that I could put, you know, say my agent on and just rent, look, for $100, I get, you know, 1,000 CPUs and, you know, banging away at this password. That would be amazing.
Because I think Elcomsoft is a Russian company. I think they, I don't know if they offer that or not, but they do stuff like that.
Oh, God. I'm not giving my data to a Russian company, though. That's the problem. No, I'm serious.
But they pass the password cracking. They make excellent password cracking software.
Yeah. There's a lot of awesome tools out there. But that was actually, this goes back to a presentation that I think John Marsh gave at CEIC talking about you know, the challenges of the stuff in the cloud, which is, okay, you've got these really great ideas coming up, like what you said. It's like, do I want to put really sensitive data, you know, a forensic investigation, you know, like my CEO's laptop image, do I want to put that, you know, in the cloud somewhere? And where does it end up? And can I ever pull that back? And, you know, let's say, you know, the data is now in, you know, wherever, you know, Absurdistan, and can I ever get it back? So, it's interesting stuff. I mean, there's a lot of potential for digital forensics and e-discovery as far as harnessing the power of all these computers sitting out there, but then there's some really serious questions about data privacy and will you ever get your data back? And I think for those of us who will work in some of the more sensitive corporate environments, I got a feeling we probably won't take advantage of a lot of that sort of thing just because we're going to be very concerned about who has our data and where it goes.
So that doesn't leave very many people left then, really, because obviously the police can't do that for fear of contraband being pushed out over the internet. And Access Data are kind of heading that way slightly. I mean, with FTK3, you can now have, I think it's 4 different computers all processing a single case at the same time. They've also got the lab edition, which, I mean, Guidance have it as well, but it's not pushed so much as the Access Data one is, where, you know, you have like one person in charge and you spread out the case amongst a team. And I honestly think that's a good way to go, but for processing on the internet, I think you're right. I think the privacy issues potentially are just too great, because it's not just your information that you're at risk of losing, but can you imagine if someone gets a sniff of some details from one of these cases that you're doing, and it gets released on the internet, then you're the one who really is screwed in that situation.
I mean, perhaps, but the military and intelligence fields are using the internet, so I'm sure it can be secured somehow. It's just a matter of time. It's just something that needs to be developed, because you have all these agencies with year-long backups and 18-month-long backups, and it's not all CP. I mean, there's other crimes going on that, you know, if they could move the data to another place, you know, to be worked on, it might cure their backlog.
As long as they're in control of the data, like, you know, the U.S. FBI, if they were to do that, you know, they would probably want their own server farm, you know, their own ability to do that so that they could, for example, have, you know, the FBI cloud, their forensic cloud, where they could have, you know, there are various RCFLs, you know, doing their stuff. You know, I could see that someday, but, you know, there's no way the FBI is going to. Well, I'm not going to say no way.
Never know
what's going to happen, but it would be a poor idea, I would think, and I think the FBI would be wildly unenthusiastic about putting, you know, Saddam Hussein's laptop on the cloud.
Well, the other thing as well is that you don't know who is maintaining the server farms either. Like, if you turned over this information to Google, I mean, it's Google employees, and you don't know them from Adam.
Oh, yeah, you have all these ITAR and export restriction stuff you have to worry about, and privileged data and all that. Yeah, I think people are going to require, for forensics and e-discovery and the stuff that we do, people are going to require a lot more data security. But for other things, I think this will, this is a trend that we'll continue to see expanding. But I think for things that deal with the legal process and sensitive data, I don't think you'll see as much haste to get involved in it.
All right. A couple other items that cropped up this week, or in the last few weeks, sorry. Paraben have released a couple of free pieces of software. They've released the P2 Shuttle free version, which seems like quite a handy little tool. This I've never used it personally. I don't know if either of you two have.
No, I haven't had a chance to use it.
I haven't used it. I use device seizure for cell phone stuff, but I don't use any of the other stuff.
No, it actually looks quite interesting. It's this tool allows like remote disk mounting, real-time live investigations, active memory capture, multi-machine searching, active file browsing of email, chat, and internet history, forensic disk investigations. So it sounds pretty good, and they've got a pro version of this as well, which costs, well, a typical about $3,000 or something like that. But the free version, I mean, obviously it's worth having a look at this if you're in some kind of corporate environment where you have to do a lot of internal investigations from the looks of things. So yeah, I mean, that's free. It's worth going and at least trying, and I'd advise it, and obviously with my advisories comes the disclaimer: I haven't used this, so don't blame me if something goes horribly wrong.
It is Blame Lee week.
Well, yeah, everyone joined the party. Come on, it's everything's my fault.
And just get my little editorial comment, folks. If you didn't get nominated for Forensic Forecast, it's not Lee's fault. The community did the nominations. All Lee did was pick the categories and tally them. So sending nasty grams to Lee because things didn't turn out the way you wanted it to is bad.
I've not really had nasty grams about the nominees or anything like that, but I've had probably three or four, I think it was like three people from no well-known companies have come to me and said, how do we get on the nominees list? And I'm like,
here's the menu of options.
And I have to respond each time. $1,000
gets you two nominations. Yeah.
Well, you know you've made it when you see in some magazine that it says, nominee on the forensics list.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. The good news is a lot of these major players are at least paying attention. So, my guess is next year you may see more lobbying, which is fine.
As a side note, I think something which was quite interesting that was mentioned on Twitter the other day is that Owen Casey's new book has a foreword by Rob Lee in it. And in that, Rob Lee lists all like his qualifications and his certifications and stuff. And then amongst that, he's like winner of Forensic Forecast Award 2009. I'm like,
there you go.
That's fantastic. That's in that's in Owen Casey's book. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
But, you've made it.
I'm immortalized. yeah. So next year should be quite interesting. But anyway, I've already talked enough about that.
You can call the trophy a Lee or a Whitfield or something.
Oh, no. As long as it's not a statue of me, I think there's not enough gold in the world for my physique. Paraben also released a decent little tool for free as well called Link2. And this thing looks really, really interesting, actually, because, I mean, personally, I've never done any phone investigations. It's never something I've really had a chance to do, unfortunately. It's something I like to do. But this little thing, What it does is if you get the phone data from like several different phones that belong to several different people, you can put them all into essentially a central database, and searches will be run trying to link these phones to each other. It's like common phone numbers, common contacts, and all those kinds of things that all be presented to you in a way which is easily readable, that you can then turn over. So if you've got like a drugs investigation for the police, or a paedophile ring or something like that, you can easily find out if you have the phones belonging to all these people, how often they've been in contact, how they are in contact, and all that kind of stuff, which I think is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, that's right. Very cool. Go ahead.
No, I think I'm agreeing with you. I think that's absolutely wonderful, because if you can establish that pattern when you get before a jury, you can say, you know, hey, this guy's talking to this guy, that guy calls back 2 minutes later, then our surveillance shows, you know, a drug transaction, and then 5 minutes later, another call, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, timelining is a big deal right now. I mean, it's a big deal in incident response and traditional forensics. You know, Harlan and Rob have been pushing that, and they have their tools to assist that. And it's the same thing in, you know, I just took the mobile device forensics class actually from Owen and Terry McGuire at Sandsfire, and that's one of the things that they were talking about is timelining with mobile device stuff. So it's good that some of the vendors are starting to develop tools to help you do I don't know if it does a timeline. I assume it probably does. Timelines and links and that sort of thing. So it's good to see some development as far as developing tools to help you put the timelines together. Because I remember when I started, you know, way back then, it was, you know, we'd use Encase to export stuff with your date and time stamps into a spreadsheet and just kind of manually cut and paste things together.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Sounds almost as interesting as e-discovery.
There's an episode of CSI in there somewhere, you know, watching Eric with eyes glazed over as he's cutting and pasting into an Excel spreadsheet. Oh, yeah, no, that'll be an award-winning show.
Oh, that's what I ever love about watching CSI, that these guys can just pull all the data off of any device, and 15 seconds later they know, you know, they can give you the guy's physical location and, you know, his description and all this good stuff.
It's fun stuff. The CSI effect. Having to explain that to clients. Oh, what a nightmare. Dear, oh dear.
They don't actually show some guy, you know, putting a drive in and waiting, you know, 4 hours for it to image.
No, absolutely.
Or not having the drive seen, and you have to update the firmware and try your alternate write blocker and your Linux boot desk, and you're basically in tears after 10 hours of it. You just walk out of the office. Although what I've always find is like, you know, what I've actually a long time ago, and this has worked out well for me, I put a cap on the amount of time I'll do forensics during a day. After 10 hours or so, it's just not a good idea to do any more work anymore. And I found that I can struggle with a problem at the end of the day. If I go home, go to sleep, I come back into the office, and like within 15 minutes, I'll knock the problem over. So I just learned that at some point your brain just glazes over and it's just a bad idea to do forensics anymore.
Well, that's the thing. I find this quite a lot, and it's unfortunate, and it shouldn't happen. But if you get tired doing anything at all, especially something as detailed as a forensic acquisition or an investigation, if you're doing that, you know, if you're pushing yourself at the end of a 12-hour day or something like that, you've got to be really, really careful that you take the time to get away from that computer and do something else, because
it's
at that point where you're most likely to make a mistake, and you may not even notice until after you've done it, and why put yourself through the agony? Just get it right the first time. Leave it until the morning if it'll wait.
Because otherwise you're going to make a mistake that's going to take you 2 hours to fix anyway. So just go home and go to sleep.
Yep, exactly. All right. Well, something which has cropped up in the last few weeks of interest is this this whole thing with Google Street View, where, and I just find this quite incredible, really, that as Google have been sending around this this car with the camera stuck on its roof to take pictures and catalog every single street in the world and et cetera, that they have also at the same time accidentally been capturing unencrypted Wi-Fi data from people's home and people's homes and businesses. Now, obviously, I've not seen the source code and the equipment involved, so I couldn't possibly comment on this. But how do you accidentally acquire, you know, petabytes of information from other people's routers and computers? I mean, that how do you just not notice that that's happening until after you've already got it?
Yeah, I haven't followed the story as closely as I kind of wish I had now, but it's from the you know, you sent us an article out at the beginning of today to review, and it was one from the BBC, and it sounds like, from reading it, they kind of ran around and violated the wiretap laws of about 30 different countries, potentially.
Yeah.
So, I just know from here in the U.S. that they're very super sensitive about that sort of thing. So the question is, you know, was this an engineer who just kind of got overzealous, or was this something a little bit more organized and had more developmental, I guess more of a developmental team behind it than one engineer? And that's what the article that you sent out was kind of discussing, which is, I think Google's position is, hey, we screwed up. We realize it's a problem. But then some people are saying, well, no, this had to be organized because, gosh, you know, the code is complex. Well, an engineer can come up with a complex code and do that sort of thing. So I don't think that's mutually exclusive. I mean, if this were Facebook, I wouldn't be giving him the benefit of the doubt because, look, you know, I keep my Facebook account. I have nothing on it other than the bare minimum terms of service stuff. I keep the account just for research purposes, but I don't use it because I don't trust them. Whereas Google, I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt because recently they have done some big, good things like pulling out of China and some other stuff. So I'm inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt, but I am curious to see how this will pan out.
Yeah, I mean, Google also have like this Skyhook type thing going on as well. I don't know if either of you two are familiar with it, where if you don't have GPS on a device, a handheld device like a phone or something like that, but you have Wi-Fi, you can use Google Maps to almost pinpoint your location as close as possible from Wi-Fi networks in the area. And these can be open, they can be encrypted, or sometimes even hidden Wi-Fi networks. Now, I'm just wondering if while they're going through doing Street View, that maybe this they were doing the Skyhook thing as well. Does that?
I just don't see this being sinister. There's no reason at all for Google to. There's no business sense. There's just no reason for them to intentionally create something to grab the data. It just doesn't make any sense. So my suspicion is this was a good idea that was just executed bad, and now they're going to have to. You know, they're a big company. They have plenty of money to spend on the lawyers to, you know, go and basically apologize and say, hey, we screwed up, and pay whatever fines. And I suspect that's what's going to happen. But my spider senses just aren't going off on this. Maybe it should, but I get a feeling it's what you'd basically just described, which is they're just trying to grab data to make their stuff cool. Because geolocation is very popular right now. You have things like Foursquare and all the other social network stuff that's built into geolocation, and Google Maps is one of their big products. So it makes sense that they would use the wireless networks as a sort of a alternative geolocation effort.
I'm fine with that. But the... what's been reported on this particular thing by the BBC, it says the independent audit of the Google system showed that the system used for the Wi-Fi collection intentionally separated out unencrypted content of communications and systematically wrote this data to the hard drives. So...
hey, my spider senses just went off. Wow!
Right.
I didn't read that, yeah.
But let's think about something. These cars are driving at, you know, 30 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour down the street. how long are they going to be in physical contact with that access point? They're not going to grab much data, are they?
Well, exactly. They're going to probably get a couple of megabytes at the very, very most. But...
So, I mean, I see the point, but I think it's way overblown.
I wonder if grabbing the unencrypted data was because there's some sort of geolocatable data that would be useful for their geolocation efforts, maybe in the unencrypted data. I'm wondering if there's a – I don't know enough about this. That's why I have to speculate. I'm wondering if there's actually a valid reason for separating the data because you'll get some information that you want for your maps application.
Well, and why – you don't really need to save the encrypted data because you don't – are you going to devote those resources to decrypting data?
Well, of course not, right?
Yeah. I think it may just be overblown. I don't know.
Okay. I mean, that's – it is possible that the whole thing was done accidentally. That – I know Google have claimed previously that the code wasn't supposed to be active as they were driving around, but someone had activated it. And it's a bit dicey because, I mean, there are certain countries that are looking to prosecute now. I know for now, the UK has said, well, we have no plans to prosecute anyone about this. But then you got countries like Germany and especially Australia. Australia have gone absolutely crazy about this. And they already got things in motion to start prosecuting them for criminal activity. So it's just...
It's a mess. They created a big mess.
But to Google's credit...
I think
credit,
it kind of boils...
Yeah. Sorry, go on.
Go ahead. I think it may depend on the individual culture's expectation of privacy that, like, in the U.S., at least, okay, the car is driving down the street, it's taking pictures of houses... who cares? Other places, they may say, hey, you know, that looks like Big Brother. You're not going to take a picture of me when I'm on the street. So, I don't know.
I don't know what they do in the States, but in Europe, they have to blur out everyone's faces, every single person who they take a picture of. Which
they do that in the U.S. now, but they didn't when Google first did it.
Yeah, I think it's certainly interesting. But to Google's credit, they actually came out and admitted this long before anybody had any idea about it.
Right.
And so in that regard, I'm inclined to believe that it was an honest mistake. But that separation of unencrypted data, it needs to be explained somewhere along the line. And unfortunately, I think the only place where we're going to hear that explanation is when a country like Australia or Germany take Google to court and ask the question why.
Excuse me, did you mean Australia or Austria?
Australia.
Okay, Australia, okay.
Yep. Yeah, a bit more right-wing in Australia than they are in Australia than they are in Austria.
Just making sure.
The last story I want to talk about this week is a rather amusing little story on the Register, involving a sex offender here in the UK who purposely has gone out to download indecent pictures of children or child porn for the vernacular, so that he would be sent back to prison. What kind of a world are we living in when someone has to resort to this?
Yeah, I read that story. One of the first things I learned as a police officer is I don't believe anything anymore. You know, I had that first year when you're a rookie where, you know, the first thing you get out in the field and you basically believe everything, and by the end of the year, you don't believe anything. And that's kind of my default. It just sounds a little too convenient, which is, oh, yes, probation officer, police, I was upset because I couldn't get housing, so I surfed child porn, you know, as a protest, so I'd go back to jail. To me, it just sounds like a clever defense argument for a sex offender who relapsed and got caught.
I have to admit, that sounds a lot more viable than what the article says. Dear, oh dear. Yeah, so...
It's possible.
Yeah, basically what's happened is that this guy has been previously jailed for 4.5 years for 2 separate serious sex offences. And he's been trying to get what's called like a council house over here, which is basically government subsidised housing. And because he wasn't able to get into any council housing, his story is that he then went and tried and downloaded more child porn so that when his parole officer had his computer checked again, they would find it and he'd go back to prison and have somewhere to live. Now, I'm leaning towards Eric's point of view here, as it at first, this guy's story seems to be really, really odd, because first of all, he denied the presence of the pictures. Then he said, oh yeah, there's pictures there, but I don't know how they got there. And his story just seems to be getting to the point where he admits it, and he's like, yeah, I do admit it, but the only reason I did it was because of this. So,
yeah.
And his quote is, it was not done for personal gratification. Well, there
yeah, because, you know, when I'm upset about housing, I surf to what a sentence in the article is. Clark Witter was back on this, denying 3 counts of possessing indecent images of children, 1 of possessing extreme pornography, 2 it, a person engaged in sexual intercourse with a live animal believed to be a horse. So, yeah, that's generally not the standard response to mortgage problems.
Well, you know, with the the housing crash in the States, there may be some market for the for defense experts there.
I know that's terrible.
Sorry.
Oh, I said I know that's terrible. Hey, did you read? There was a story back in April about this guy that he broke into his neighbor's house and planted some CP on the guy's machine. And then he called the local cops and said, hey, this guy has CP on his machine.
Oh, no.
And they eventually caught him. I'm not sure how they caught him. I think I saw it on The Guardian. It was back in April. I'll take a look and see if I can find the story. But.
Wow. Oh, that would be a very interesting case.
Yeah, I would think you'd get the big hammer on that. You would get a pretty significant burglary charge. You'd get a possession charge, probably a distribution charge. That would be a very bad idea.
I think he was in love with his neighbor's wife, and I think that's what happened.
Oh, dear. Oh,
and he was
dear.
Trying to like get the husband out of the way. I've got I made a YouTube video of it, and it's one of my YouTube videos. So I can't remember the details, unfortunately.
Dear, oh dear, the lengths that some people go to. I mean, I know there's been I've heard of a few cases that aren't too dissimilar to that. And you think, you know, if you're going to try and get someone in trouble, there's better ways of doing it than that. Because if you get found out, you go to prison. So, right. I mean, yeah, it's unbelievable. Mind you, if people were smart, they wouldn't be committing crimes. So, I guess it goes that.
Well, they would be committing crimes, but the smart ones get caught eventually. But yeah.
All right. All right. So I think that's it for the news. I think there was something else that we wanted to discuss for a little bit here. Ron, you had a question about corporate environments and child porn and contraband. Do you want to?
Right. Sure. My question is, what kind of advice can forensics people give to first responders in corporate environments? Because if somebody calls the help desk and says, hey, you know, I've got something on my computer, I don't know what it is, the help desk is more likely to just go ahead and erase it or re-image the machine. And if you're in a situation where you have a preserve letter or it's actual contraband, you probably don't want to just wipe the machine because you bring in issues of spoliation, et cetera. So I'm wondering what kind of advice as a forensics practitioners that we can give to the organizations that we work with in order to not commit that initial mistake, you know, that first responder mistake.
All right. So, Eric, I know that you, having been in the police and now being a corporate investigator, what kind of things do you have in place for something like this?
You know, anytime you have anything that may go to law enforcement, and especially if it's something, you know, it's very serious, like contraband, you're the first thing you should do is stop, drop, and roll. You know, don't do anything to damage the evidence or reimage a machine or anything like that. And then you may need to beat feet very quickly to your legal counsel and have a discussion with them. And then what you should do is, with your legal counsel, you should immediately go out and contact, the appropriate law enforcement agency. And then that your counsel will advise you how to deal with the law enforcement agency as far as turning over data and how to do that, because there's labor laws and privacy laws depending on the country you're involved in. But with contraband, it's contraband. You're going to have to contact the police. So the best way to do that is just make sure your internal counsel knows what's going on. You have a quick huddle with them and then engage law enforcement and follow their directions to the letter.
Hmm. Now, I don't know necessarily how it works in the States, but obviously, you know, if a law has been committed, then it has to be if a law has been broken, it has to be reported. But I mean, I know a lot of people may be concerned that they have like a server which they may find some contraband on, but this server is critical to their business needs and they need it to continue running and everything else. What kind of things can people expect if they report these things to the police? Because there may be a bit of indecision on reporting it, because first, they don't want the company to be tarnished with something like that. But then second of all, they want to keep operating. They don't want the police to come in and interrupt their work and lose the money.
Right, and also consider issues. Oh, I'm sorry. Also consider issues if you're like in a legal environment and you have client data on there, you know, things that are privileged.
Yeah, and that's why you need to contact your counsel, because if there's other data going out the door, you're going to need to, you know, have a conversation with the law enforcement people about how you're going to do the handoff. And it's best to have your counsel involved in that so they know what's going on. As far as, you know, I can only speak to U.S. law enforcement because that's kind of my experience here. And I didn't do technical investigations as a police officer. I'm actually I've learned about how U.S. law enforcement operates actually after I left in the private sector to do technical investigations. But that said, U.S. law enforcement is very sensitive about, they understand that if they come into an organization like a bunch of bulls in a china shop and shut things down and cause business disruption, one, there are certain legal liabilities they have to worry about, and two, that really hurts their police community relations. So any contact I've ever had and any contact I've ever heard about my peers having with law enforcement has always been law enforcement, they're very sensitive about this. They have very, you know, we travel in the same circles. You know, a lot of the police, digital police, the people who are in law enforcement who digital forensics travel the same circles as the rest of us. So we tend to know each other. So they have the same skill sets. You know, a lot of times what happens is you run off of the lawyer. The lawyers have the contact with the police, and they kind of bless you having you go talk to the police. You develop a plan. You go back to the attorney. The attorney says, fine, go for it. And everyone's happy. You can take information off of a server without having to shut things down. What I tell people is do not be afraid to contact law enforcement. They're here to work with you. They will not shut your business down. They don't have any, it doesn't do them any good to splash an organization's name all over the front pages. But if you don't, if you cover up a crime, and somebody, you know, reports it to law enforcement, then you know, all bets are off. You're going to have a hostile confrontation with law enforcement, and that's not a good idea. So you know, granted, I'm ex-law enforcement and I'm doing my officer-friendly routine here, but it's true. You know, the law enforcement officers, they want to be contacted, they want to help, they will not shut your business down.
I think also in regards to, you know, the client confidentiality stuff that you have going on, it's my belief that, I mean, I can't speak for everywhere, my belief that investigations of criminality trump anything, and if your clients try to come back and sue you for that, then there are legal protections for your organization that will stop that from happening.
I think some I haven't done, you know, I've never worked as an independent consultant before, but I know some of the ones I've talked to, and Lee, I'd be curious what you guys do. I know some of them actually put in their, you know, their contracts saying, look, if we find child porn or if we find, you know, criminal activity, here's how things are going to be handled. So I know in some cases they just handle that up front, and that's just part of the work agreement.
It's probably a very smart thing to do, really, because even if you got these protections in place, it could be months before anything comes of it. But if it's all set out beforehand, then there's absolutely no room for argument whatsoever.
Oh, and with contraband, I tell people, it's like, you know, here in the U.S., you can no more have a picture of contraband images, you know, images of child sex abuse. You can no more have that sitting in, you know, a locker somewhere than you can have a pound of cocaine. Yeah. So contraband is contraband is contraband. So that's why you got to work with your attorneys and you got to reach out to law enforcement.
Right, because I think as just computer technicians who go out to a client's house, if they see something like that, I've heard of, there was a story that someone saw contraband and in order to show it to the cops, they printed it out and took it down to the local police station. And I'm not sure what the police did, but I don't think it ended up very well for them. I think it was one of those, hey, see, this guy has bad stuff on his computer. Here's a printout.
Oh, no.
Well, that's a good faith effort.
Your possession, yeah.
No, it's not a good idea. I wouldn't encourage it. But, you know, if I were a police officer, it's like, all right, next time, just call. But, you know, thank you for the tip.
Thank you for the tip, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Well, I was an Air Force cop for 6 years, but back then computers had 8-inch floppy drives on them. So, and the worst thing, the porn on those kind of computers just wasn't that interesting.
I do think that things are slightly different between here and there, because like over here, if there's contraband, it is. That's entirely a police thing. Like that investigation will be conducted by the police. There's no third party involved, nothing. And even for defense, a defense investigator would have to go and conduct that investigation at the where the evidence is being held. Over here, the police subcontract out the work. So, you know, I mean, every single company I've worked for, up to Disc Labs, has, you know, I've been exposed to that kind of material outside of police, and there's certain steps in place that prevent the company from being prosecuted for it and all that kind of stuff. And then defense people, exactly the same. If they have a just cause for having those items, then they can have them and they can work with them and do whatever they need to. Yeah. But there has to be a certain, you know, a very, very narrow road to sit on. Obviously, if you start backing things up and it gets a little bit hazy difficult. Then.
Well, we have a company called Best Buy, and they have computer people called Geek Squad.
Yep.
And they go out and fix computers, and every once in a while someone will bring in a computer to Best Buy or Geek Squad, they'll go out and they'll find, I don't know how these guys find these illicit images if they're just like fixing the guy's sound card, but they seem to find it.
You know how they're finding the images.
Yeah. Yeah. But the, you know, the customer comes in to get his computer and they say, hey, the manager needs to talk to you just for a second.
Yep.
And then they walk out in cuffs, which is a good thing.
Well, we've got similar things happen everywhere, I'm sure. Over here, there's a big chain called PC World, and they, the number of cases that I've seen where someone took their computer in for repairs and that's how they've been found out is quite high percentage, really, of the cases that are conducted over here.
Which seems like you have to be a really stupid pedophile to do that.
Now, I don't want to cause a fuss or anything. Are there any? Do you know any intelligent pedophiles?
No, I can't say I do.
Using the football terminology, it's a colossal own goal.
All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there. But thanks for joining us again this week. Thank you, Eric, for being on again.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure.
And people can find you, Eric J. Huber, on Twitter.
Yeah, and then I've got my blog, and what I've done is I've actually registered ericjhuber.com. That's ericjhuber.com. And that actually points to my my blogspot blog. It's ericjhuber.blogspot.com. And like I said, on Twitter, I'm happy to have people follow me. It's always fun. We always have good conversations on Twitter.
When you say always.
Well, all right. Let me revise and extend. Rarely do we have good conversations on Twitter, but it's still always fun.
Yep. So, yeah, Eric's blog, known as A Fistful of Dongles, when nominations open Forensic Forecast Awards next year.
Yeah, so what you guys didn't vote for.
Then nominate it next year, and he'll get the top geeky awards we're going to hand out this year.
I'm so excited to see the awards now.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be fun. They are actually going to be cool.
Go ahead.
That's all right, I'm done.
Oh, I said that's a topic you have to bring up someday is dongle overcrowding. When you're trying to image a machine and you have so many dongles that you run out of USB ports.
I can't comment on dongles, unfortunately. I'm going to have to rule myself out of that conversation because Shadow Analyzer is likely to go that way. So, via USB hub, that's my advice. Ron, thank you for joining us this week also.
Sure.
And it's been a pleasure having you on.
Okay. You can find, I have a whole bunch of videos of me taking hard drives out of computers, and it's on YouTube under Forensors, Forensource.
Cool stuff. And Ron's always posting humorous comments on the Forensic Forecast website as well. Some bordering on insulting at times.
Thank you, sir.
Yep. Oh, it's been a pleasure having you both on. And, yep, as always, if you want to catch up with anything, go to forensicforecast.com. Follow at Forecast on Twitter. There's the LinkedIn page. There's the Facebook page. You find us anywhere. And I'm at Schizofreud on on Twitter as well. So thank you for joining us again, and we'll catch you next time. Don't forget to vote on the Forensic Forecast Awards. Take care.